Welcome to Bridging the Bones, a podcast exploring the causes, context, and occasional solutions to conflict. I'm your host, Sodaline Wang.
I continue to be shocked at the degree to which medical personnel will report people who've miscarried to the police when there's, you know, when miscarriage is very common. And
our guest today is Dr. Kathleen Crowther, author of Policing Pregnant Bodies, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. She conducts research on the history of science, technology, and medicine at Oklahoma University. Please note that this episode contains content not suitable to many younger listeners and may be difficult for those who recently experienced miscarriage. We start off with a summary of the patchwork complexity of U.S. abortion laws.
So you have states like my own, I'm in Oklahoma, where abortion at all stages is illegal, with some very limited exceptions for preserving the life of the mother. And then I think Florida is a good example, where there are these 6-week abortion bans, and the ban on abortion after 6 weeks is essentially a heartbeat. Those are derived from the heartbeat laws. The heartbeat laws ban abortion after 6 weeks, and they're because 6 weeks is about as early as you can detect any kind of cardiac activity in a fetus. So you still have those, and then you have other states where abortion is still legal through the second trimester. So,
and not belabor the point, yeah. So to speak. The Dobbs decision, if I understand it right, was basically the Supreme Court, which is, you know, the ultimate arbiter of legal authority in the United States, basically kicking the abortion debate back to the states, more or less.
Yes.
Like saying, you know, you're in whatever state, you're in Texas, you're in Florida, you're in Oregon, you do what your state says.
Yes, that's right. Okay.
So speaking of the fetal heartbeat bills and laws now, I feel like it's a pretty important point that the heart is described both in metaphorical terms and in biological terms.
Yes.
Right. I think you mentioned like the metaphorical heart versus the biological heart.
Yes. So in everyday speech, we talk about the heart as in terms like we talk about the soul or as the kind of the seat of personhood. So we talk about having a heart-to-heart talk, or we talk about our hearts being broken, or we talk about, you know, something coming from the heart. So that view of the heart, which we recognize if we think about it as metaphorical, right? I think most people who use those, who talk about having a heart-to-heart aren't thinking of kind of like the literal heart as an organ that pumps blood, or the sort of the biological heart. That notion of the heart as sort of the seat of the emotions and passions, or sometimes the heart as the seat of thought, the heart as the seat of personhood, that is an idea that goes back, that is one of those ideas that goes back to the ancient Greeks, and that was certainly kind of incorporated into Christian thought and theology, so that the proponents of the heartbeat laws are drawing on those metaphorical associations of the heart with personhood. Although they often claim that what they're doing is talking about science, because, you know, when they say that you can hear a fetal heartbeat at 6 weeks, which, you know, you absolutely cannot, because at 6 weeks, a fetus does not, first of all, an embryo does not have a heart with chamber. And maybe that's important to actually just say, in case this is unclear. That developing entity, embryo, fetus, does not have a heart in the sense of like this organ with four chambers that pumps blood throughout the body. And when you listen to, if a doctor puts a stethoscope to your chest and listens to your heart, what they're hearing is the blood moving through these vessels of your heart, that kind of lub-dub sound. And you could hear it, like if you just put your ear against someone's chest, you can hear that kind of lub-dub sound of the heart moving. That is not what you're hearing when a physician uses an ultrasound to on a pregnant person with a 6 week old fetus.
I'm sorry. So at that stage, they're not even using a fetal heart monitor. They're just using ultrasound.
They're just using ultrasound. And actually, I believe it has to be a vaginal ultrasound. So it's not even, so maybe that's also relevant because that's actually an intrusive procedure. This is not like laying an ultrasound wand on the belly. This is a vaginal ultrasound that's inserted.
It's like a mic with a device that sends out a sound pulse that they insert into the vagina.
Yes. Okay. What it can sometimes in a fetus as young as 6 weeks detect is the electrical pulsing of cells that will, if the fetus develops, will develop into the heart. So that's a lot of the heartbeat bills, if you read them, have to sort of specify cardiac activity, because what we're talking about is just cells that will, if the fetus develops, develop into the heart. And the ultrasound, the machine kind of translates those into that lub-dub, 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 which sounds like a heartbeat, but it's not the same thing as what you're hearing through a stethoscope or what you would hear through a fetal monitor much later in pregnancy.
I do want to make sure that we go into the subject of not just the everyday colloquialisms about the heart, but also the religious aspects of this, because I observe that there's a lot of heart imagery.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And my understanding of that is that this is related to Catholic teaching and Catholic, you know, sermons and whatnot, relating to the heart. And you notice in the book that, like, Lutherans also, for instance, also have a lot of heart imagery. So I feel like this isn't just a coincidence, right?
Yes. I mean, you could talk about kind of any number of, like, kidney function develops fairly early or some rudimentary form of kidney function, but we don't talk about kidney function laws. There is a reason that it's the heart, because the heart has kind of cultural resonance that no other organ has. It has religious significance. It has, even for people who are not religious, like, again, these sort of metaphors about the heart are so kind of pervasive that I think, in a way, it's hard to talk about the heart sometimes in purely kind of biological terms. But it certainly has been very, very, it is often evoked in sermons across the spectrum of Christianity, Catholic, Protestant, liberal, conservative, the images of this kind of, like, language of, like, of the heart,
like the thorns,
like
the hoop of thorns around the heart, around the flaming heart. I see that a lot as well.
And I mean, this is another thing, we don't, like, the heart is what makes us, like, human. Like, you know, our brains are, like, connected with, like, rationality and objectivity, but the heart is associated with, like, passion and emotion, and it's somehow kind of, it's like what makes us us. And
I just want to clarify, when you say heart is what makes us us, are you speaking as yourself? Are you speaking as what viewpoint are you speaking from?
Okay, I'm speaking, like, I guess, in the first instance, from the perspective of kind of early Christians and the ancient Greeks and Romans, who saw kind of the heart as the seat of emotions. And the brain maybe is associated with rationality, but in the ancient world, and for early Christians too, there's an association of kind of like rationality with the divine. And so our brains maybe are, you know, there's a belief that we're more rational than other animals. That makes us closer to God for early, you know, for early Christians, but also for the ancient Greeks and Romans. There's like a lot of heavy influence of ancient Greek and Roman thought on early Christian thought.
You mentioned Aristotle a lot.
Yeah. And Aristotelian ideas are really influential in their own time, but also on like subsequent Christians. But the heart is kind of like what makes us like more human. And that's why the heart is associated with Jesus so much, because it like that's the central mystery of Christianity, right? It's like God becoming human. So like the heart, that's why the heart of Jesus has this significance in theology and in imagery and sermons, etc. In a way, like nobody talks about the brain of Jesus. That's not a thing, right?
I think part of what's interesting is that there was also a very specific claim by Aristotle, for instance, that what's special about the human, that there's something special about the human soul, mm-hmm. and that the human soul resides in the heart.
Yes.
Or like it comes into the heart or something like that,
yeah.
at an early stage in development. Whereas he posits that other creatures, like, I mean, and Aristotle was actually one of the first people to do careful dissections,
yeah.
of animals. So even though he dissected all these other animals, he placed the human soul specifically in a special place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think animal souls also reside in the heart, but the animal soul is not capable of rationality in the way that the human soul is. So like human souls are superior to animal souls in Aristotle's view.
And do you feel like that figures into the abortion debate? Like, is, I'm looking at this because at a very early stage, right, in fetal development,
mm-hmm.
the human fetus doesn't resemble a human in particular. Like,
yes,
there's a lot of similarities between a human fetus and a mouse fetus and a pig fetus and like a lizard fetus. You can't really tell which one is which unless you're like specifically trained.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So this got transmitted to present day anti-abortion legislators, lawmakers, even though, you know, like there's no direct continuity between ancient Greece or Rome and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And also that those were, as you say, pagan cultures, right? Whereas the most of the Christians who are proposing these kinds of laws are very staunchly anti-pagan,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes. Yeah.
So how is this cultural transmission happening? How are these early attempts at science, you know, becoming enshrouded within a worldview, right, that is in many ways both similar but also very different?
One part of the answer is that a lot of these ancient Greek and Roman ideas were appropriated by Christians and were Christianized in various ways. So Aristotle's ideas about the heart and the soul are kind of ancient Greek and Roman ideas about the soul are taken into, appropriated by Christians and Christian. I mean, the concept of the soul is one that comes out of Greek and Roman philosophy. It's not in its origins a religious concept, but it becomes a religious concept when it's adopted and transformed by Christians. And yet it's never fully stripped of its origins. Because I think early Christians, medieval Christians, even in early modern Christians, found a lot of value in ancient culture. And they took and transformed ideas like the soul, or, these understandings of reproduction that they found, useful into kind of like Christian concepts, which still like impact kind of Christians today. For example, talked a bit earlier about fetus, very early, like embryos and fetuses don't look recognizably human. But the question of like when a fetus looks recognizably human, like really informs to this day debates about abortion. And so kind of, anti-abortion activists, consistently sort of push back the kind of the early, not just the heart, but like the appearance of like fingers and a face and kind of human, like that it's human-like appearance as early as possible. And I think that goes back to an idea from the ancient Greeks that like when that the fetus gets a soul when it has a human form. That's another like strand of kind of like ancient thought, but it's one that actually is taken over by Christians.
And just to be clear, there's actually no like quantitative, non-subjective analysis that you can use to distinguish when a fetus is, justifiably abortable and not abortable.
That's, yes. In some ways, I think the Roe decision, which put that line at viability.
Wait, just to be clear, when you say Roe, you mean like the Roe v. Wade decision.
Mm-hmm. So, the Roe v. Wade decision said a state could, doesn't have to, but a state can regulate or even prohibit abortion after the point of viability. That after the point of that viability, meaning that the fetus could survive outside the womb. So, roughly the third trimester. But even that is, that is a somewhat arbitrary. That's not quantifiable either, like, to be honest, because whether a fetus can survive outside the womb at like 7 months, for example, depends a lot on, are you living in Los Angeles next to like, UCLA Medical Center, and, you can get top of the line, absolutely state of the art, neonatal intensive care, or do you live in rural Oklahoma where, the nearest hospital may be 4 hours away. Like,
Well, right? And I do want to note that part of what subconsciously enters into this perception of viability is the fact that most medical TV programs that you see, right, that involve the theme of early delivery of preemies, premature infants. Like most of those TV shows happen in urban, well-resourced hospitals. Those do not at all represent a very large percentage of hospitals and maternal medical centers in the United States.
Yes.
So what people perceive through their television sets as what seems viable, right? Which is, of course, also, milked for emotional traction.
Yeah.
For maximum tears and joy and whatnot. Those television representations often don't represent what's in reality on the ground in their neighborhood or in their county or whatnot.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
We're interviewing history of science, technology, and medicine professor Kathleen Crowther on her book, Policing Pregnant Bodies. We will return after a short break. Tick tock, tick tock. We know how important your time is, so we keep each episode between 30 and 55 minutes long. It might surprise you that each episode of Bridging the Bones requires over 24 hours of editing. For this interview alone, there's a lot of content, over 45 minutes, that we left on the cutting room floor. Luckily, we have bonus material, where we dive deeper into the topic and take unexpected but exciting detours. You can access this material by becoming a subscriber. Go to bridgingthebones.fyi to see how you can become a member. Thank you for your support. Welcome back to our interview with Dr. Kathleen Crowther as we explore the influence of ancient Greek and Roman culture on modern U.S. thinking about pregnancy and the fetus.
One of the big examples I use in the book is the metaphor bun in the oven. Like, why we still, this is a metaphor that we still use. It's a kind of cutesy way of talking about, like, you know, pregnancy, a sort of cute, euphemistic way of talking about pregnancy. But it's a metaphor that was used by the ancient Greeks. And in a way, like, why should this make sense to us anymore? You know, our ideas about reproduction are very, very different from the ancient Greeks. I mean, they had no idea about, you know, sperm and, like, eggs. I mean, they talked in terms of male and female seed, like, meeting in the uterus. So their ideas about reproduction are very, very different. And yet this metaphor, this bun in the oven metaphor, like, has persisted for 2,000 years. And the bun in the oven metaphor presumes that all of the real, like, work, because when you bake bread, when you make a bun, like, when you make buns, all the work goes on, the active work goes on before you put that bun in the oven. All that's happening in the oven is there's a heat source, and that allows the bread to bake, or the fetus to, you know, form. So it's a metaphor that implies that the female body plays a purely passive role in reproduction, and that actually, you know, what's in the oven is not really connected to the oven. It's completely separate from the oven itself. This is the kind of thing that I'm talking about, that even though we have this tremendously more advanced scientific understanding of reproduction, we're still thinking about the relationship between the pregnant person and the fetus in ways that would have been very familiar to the ancient Greeks.
I also note this parallel. I'm looking at what you're writing about the Romans, you know, the Roman Empire, and the ancient Greeks. And of course, these weren't all ancient Greeks, but, like, a certain subset of ancient Greeks represented by people like Aristotle, that there's a sort of cultural borrowing that perhaps consciously or subconsciously kind of also reflects a particular view of ownership.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Of the fetus.
Yes.
Or of the infant. Could you talk about that a little?
Yeah. Well, to return to the kind of bun in the oven metaphor, the bun belongs to the baker, not to the oven. So there's a very long tradition of seeing the fetus as the sort of property of the father. And that manifests in kind of a variety of ways. So to the extent that the kind of Greeks and Romans were opposed to abortion, it was not really because they saw the fetus as a separate person with a right to life, but that they saw the fetus as the property of the father, and abortion as, I don't know, do I say a kind of a theft of that property. I kind of see these ideas kind of continuing to be reflected, you know, even today. This, I mean, there is certainly a new sense, a new kind of argument, which arose, you know, in the 20th century, really, that, you know, that the fetus is a person with this notion of kind of like fetal personhood. But even, you know, this sense that the state has some kind of duty to protect this, the, you know, the unborn, does seem to kind of like, you know, reflects a sense that kind of pregnant people should not have, are not the ones who should be deciding kind of what happens to fetuses. There's this ongoing sense that, and a sense that kind of fetuses need to be protected from pregnant people, which is kind of another sort of the flip side of this, if you will. The idea that pregnant people, and this goes back to the ancient Romans, pregnant people, pregnant women, because like that's what they're thinking of in the ancient world, you know, the kind of women who want to like have abortions are selfish, are promiscuous, are irresponsible, and, you know, doing this to kind of conceal adulterous affairs, etc. And this, you know, sort of same line about kind of like the type of woman who wants to have an abortion carries through to this day, which is of course utter like nonsense. Women, pregnant people have been terminating pregnancies for a bajillion different reasons, you know, since all of recorded history. There is not kind of like this sort of like single type. But yeah, this sense of kind of masculine ownership over the fetus.
I feel like this idea of ownership is actually somewhat central, because just as the ancient Greeks and Romans felt and you know, legally, you know, enforced this idea that the fetus and the baby that eventually might develop belonged solely to the father, there's also this kind of transmittal of that in many respects to the U.S. South, mm-hmm. and how in the 1700s, 1800s, Black women, of course they didn't use the word Black, but you know, back then they used the word Negro, that Black enslaved women were the properties,
yeah.
and their children, of course, also,
yes.
were the properties of the slave owners, who
yes.
were pretty much always men.
Like, yep.
like there were women who helped to run households, like the women married to the slave owners, but it was still pretty much predominantly or entirely owned by men, mm-hmm. by white men. Is that a strange parallel, or is that very intentional? I guess it doesn't feel coincidental to me, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. No, I don't think it is. You know, even though, like, we today know considerably more about reproduction than people in the past did, I still feel like there are a lot of ways in which we think of the female role in reproduction as passive and the male role as active. And so the fetus really is the product of the male and the property of the male. You know, there's wonderful work by the anthropologist Emily Martin on kind of the ways in which we talk about egg and sperm, for example, and the she's in biology textbooks and popular culture, all kinds of ways we think of like the egg as just floating gently through the fallopian tube and the sperm as these sort of like active, like, and to go back to the bun in the oven metaphor, you don't worry that much about your oven. Like, you don't think your oven needs, you know, like how good a care do you take of your oven, really? One way is that kind of a lot of people, and this is anyone who's never been pregnant, so this includes women as well as men, you know, a lot of people who have never been pregnant have very little sense of what that's actually like. I mean, there is also, like, when people get pregnant, like when I got pregnant, there is like a tremendous shock because most of what we learn about pregnancy is actually fetal development. And all the bizarre things that can happen to the maternal body during pregnancy, that's not in biology textbooks. That's not really it depicted in popular culture. It's not like it's a really kind of startling and disorienting thing. Like one of the examples that I use in the book of this sort of like weird sort of ignorance about pregnancy is the way that people reacted after Kate Middleton gave birth for the first time. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting her actual title, the Princess of Wales, but she wasn't the Princess of Wales then. She was the Duchess of Cambridge. When she first gave birth and then like came out like a, you know, within 24 hours on the steps of the hospital holding this infant. And people are like, what the hell? Why is she still fat? Like as though they thought that somehow, like, I mean, there were like actually British television had like, you know, got midwives on to like explain this to people. Like that's like a kind of a level of ignorance about kind of like the state of pregnancy I don't know, that's just kind of incredible. I think this is connected to this very long tradition as of kind of seeing pregnant women as just sort of incubators for babies and not devoting enough kind of time and care and attention to the kind of experience, the sort of the lived experience of pregnancy.
On the flip side, you do mention that there was a long tradition of this fear of maternal imagination.
Yeah.
Like if a woman, while having sex that would lead to pregnancy, was like looking at an ugly statue, for instance,
yeah,
that the baby would turn out ugly. And you kind of trace how that in some ways echoes present day concerns about the emotional states of women during pregnancy.
So that is another strain I trace in the book, yes, of this belief that the fetus has to be protected from the pregnant person, and that the interests of the pregnant person are in some ways kind of antagonistic to, and also that women being naturally irrational and emotional are kind of poor caretakers of fetuses. So pregnant women need to be supervised very carefully to avoid kind of damaging their fetuses. So yeah, you talk about the concept of kind of maternal imagination. This is an idea, again, goes back to the ancient Greeks, continues on really up until the 19th century in some forms. The idea that if at the moment of conception, the pregnant person is like looking at an ugly statue or, you know, something that that the baby will turn out ugly. But extended to the idea that, you know, hair lips are caused by pregnant women being startled by rabbits, all kinds of, you know, anything startling, frightening, that the pregnant person sees can imprint itself on the fetus. I mean, and that's, you know, partly a measure of this sort of irrationality and kind of instability of the kind of female mind that, like, you know, it's imprinting these sort of irrational things on the fetus. But they're like, on the one hand, that means, you know, you want to be very careful, like pregnant women should not be exposed to, like, you know, shocking or frightening or whatever, you know, things, because these can cause miscarriages, they can cause, defects in the fetus. But these ideas kind of continue, again, like up to the present day. So in the 19th century, you see kind of like things start to shift from, you know, it's not like if you see a rabbit, your baby will have a hair lip. But, you know, if you're angry or anxious or, you know, have sort of negative emotions during pregnancy, then your baby will be affected. And it continues up to the present day. There are tons and tons and tons of like studies of, you know, the effects of maternal emotion and stress now on the developing fetus, and relatively far fewer. So we assume that dangers to the fetus come from primarily from the pregnant person. And I can expand on that because I think that's where you get this tendency now to criminalize miscarriage and to kind of blame women for any kind of poor pregnancy, or to blame the pregnant person for poor pregnancy outcomes, whether that's miscarriage or stillbirth or any kind of, you know, congenital issues with the baby.
Sorry, just to preempt you a little bit, I do notice, and I'm not somebody who watches as much television as I used to, but there is a very different outlook or very different media framing of when like a celebrity has a miscarriage.
Yeah.
Right. And then the ways in which those, you know, let's be honest, public relations teams coached reveals of miscarriage, how those differ markedly from how the public often reacts to the miscarriage of a poor person or a non-white person.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. And it's not even just the public. I continue to be shocked at the degree to which medical personnel will report people who've miscarried to the police when there's, you know, when miscarriage is very common and has, you know, rarely has any kind of discernible cause. I should say, like, really, most miscarriages just happen. So but the fact that kind of, you know, some of the kind of highly publicized cases that we've seen of women being prosecuted for miscarriages, they come to the attention of authorities because medical personnel like report them. Well, which, you know,
is that because of hospital or legal mandates that they report, or is it just like that they want to report because they feel like this particular mother, and let's be clear, is often poor and is often non-white.
White, yeah.
Or in some other way, like lacking in the status and privileges of politicians and celebrities.
Yeah.
Or is this a reflection of a tendency that even goes beyond what's legally mandated to want to blame poor and non-white people?
I think it's the latter. I do not think, actually, I'm sure there is, I believe, no legal mandate to report a self-managed abortion, if that's what it is. And you're talking about people doing this in the absence of any conclusive proof that what happened was a self-managed abortion. In some cases, I think the line may be a little grayer if there's been illicit drug use, possibly. But even there, like, I actually think that this is a clear violation of medical ethics for both physicians and nurses to be kind of reporting patient information like this. So yes, I think it does spring from a desire to kind of like, you know, punish these, poor and non-white women who are, you know, I would note also, you know, say, I would say, particularly Black women, are at much higher risk of being kind of reported for miscarriage. They're also the ones who are receiving kind of the least good maternal health care, right? Because they're the ones with the highest rate by far of maternal and infant mortality. They're receiving kind of the least compassionate, the least aggressive and evidence-based kind of maternity care, and they're subject to the kind of the highest levels of surveillance of their pregnancy.
And scrutiny.
Yes.
And you note this a few times in your book that there is a simultaneous desire to place all or most of the burden of blame of miscarriage or of unhealthy infants on poor and people of color. There's this predominance of this narrative of, well, if the baby didn't come out, or if the fetus, something went wrong during the pregnancy, that it's the mother's fault, rather than, oh, well, what is in the larger environment that might have produced this effect?
Yeah, I think when things go wrong with pregnancies, people are looking for explanation. People, by which I mean both lay people and kind of medical personnel, often kind of looking for a cause in something that the pregnant person did wrong. One of the cases that I talk about in the book is one in Oklahoma where a Native American woman, when she miscarried, and she did tell hospital personnel when she miscarried that, she had used some kind of illicit drugs. And, so there was an autopsy done on the fetus. And first of all, there's no indication that like occasional drug use that she'd engaged in had anything to do with the miscarriage. She also like lives in an area where fracking goes on, and fracking has been known to raise the rate of miscarriage. So one of the questions I ask in the book is, why is that not a factor? Why did the judge, the prosecutor, the jury not say, what's in this woman's environment that might have, because we know that rates of miscarriage are higher around fracking sites. Why are we not looking for the cause of miscarriage in these fracking sites? Why are we looking for it in like, something that this woman did? And I see that as a kind of pervasive pattern. So, for example, one of the things I do is compare the just this is very rough, but the number of medical studies on the impact of like maternal stress on the fetus compared to the number of studies on the impact of environmental toxins on fetuses. And you're talking like it's a the second is just a fraction of the first. So, our whole kind of mindset, both public and medical, is that if something goes wrong with the pregnancy, it must be something that the woman, the pregnant person, did wrong, not that, she lives in an area where she lives in a food desert, so she can't access, fresh fruits and vegetables, and she can't, maintain a kind of, really the ideal healthy diet, or we know that kind of people who are poor, and particularly people of color, are more likely to live in areas with environmental toxins, right? So, but that's not where we look.
And for the non-US audience, perhaps it's helpful to provide some international context. So you note in your book that, for instance, I think Ireland, so actual country of Ireland, not Northern Ireland,
specifically significantly liberalized, or I don't know what's the best word for it, but
yeah,
significantly reduced. Like they had a very notable change. You know, Ireland is a very Catholic country.
Yeah. Right?
What's the international context for U.S. abortion laws?
Yeah. So in the case of Ireland, I mean, I think they had very restrictive abortion laws, in that I think abortion at all stages was illegal, unless maybe they had some exception for the life of the mother. And then, you know, while there had been kind of political activism and sort of push to change Ireland's abortion laws, that was really kind of galvanized by the death of Savita Halappanavar, who went into a Dublin hospital miscarrying at 17 weeks and was denied a kind of therapeutic abortion. Because at that point the fetus still had a heartbeat, and she got sepsis and died. And that is what will happen if you have these incredibly kind of restrictive abortion laws. Even if the laws allow for an abortion when there is risk to the life of the mother, even in those cases, you're going to get women dying or pregnant people dying, which is what happened. And so that kind of really galvanized sort of big shifts in a kind of liberalization of Irish abortion law, where I think my sense is abortion is still restricted in Ireland, but not, I think, kind of within the first trimester now, kind of abortion is legal and obtainable in Ireland more easily. You know, we've seen that like south of the border here, kind of Mexico's significantly liberalized their abortion laws. So the United States, with this sort of like patchwork of very tight restrictions and kind of more open, like it's like we are a sort of a microcosm of the global situation, where, you know, some countries have these sort of like incredibly kind of restrictive laws, where, you know, like some Central American countries where women are routinely jailed for miscarriage, which, you know, that happens also in the United States, and then other sort of states with laws that permit abortion within the first and second trimesters. But I will, to come back to the Irish case, Savita Halappanavar, that what's striking to me is very obvious that that's going to happen if abortion is made illegal. And we have seen that in the United States now. There have definitely been, you know, some cases of pregnant people who died because they were denied. That does not seem to be kind of shifting public opinion in the same way that it did in Ireland. I don't have a good explanation for that, but
you write something interesting in this chapter called The Fetus in the Bottle. And it's the very end of the chapter. And when you had recently graduated from college, didn't say undergraduate or graduate school, but you were inside the College of Physicians of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And you were looking at what can be charitably described as something that looks like a mad scientist laboratory.
Yes.
And there were like jars and jars of fetuses with very obvious mutations.
Yeah.
And whereas you were looking at that and you felt uncomfortable?
Yeah. I mean, because looking at these fetuses in jars, I just couldn't imagine like women actually giving birth to these fetuses. It seemed like many of these women must have died trying to give birth to these fetuses. I mean, we're talking about like conjoined twins, for example, like hydrocephalus with an extremely large head. I saw like my first thought was there's no way that these women actually gave birth to these babies and lived through it, right? So and these fetuses are, you know, were collected. I don't know. My main thought is like, oh my God, those poor women, like what a horrible, horrible way to die.
Maybe I'm twisted, but there was also a male medical student with you at the time.
Yeah.
And he didn't seem at all bothered by these fetuses. But when you two were walking through this exhibit hall, he came upon like some jars that were of diseased testicles.
Yes. Yeah.
And then he became thoroughly like he became extremely disgusted.
That's right. I thought he was joking. But it turned out, no, he actually was having the same reaction looking at those diseased testicles that I was having looking at all of these like fetuses. Like, oh my God, that must have really hurt. Like, that would be really painful. Yeah.
Well, not even being there, but just reading your account of it, I couldn't help but feel like this scene is sort of a microcosm of a crisis of empathy. Mm-hmm. And that this kind of visceral, this very contrasting visceral reactions.
Yeah.
To this horror house of things in jars sort of illustrates this kind of larger problem.
Yeah.
Of how people identify with certain kinds of pain and not other kinds of pain. And that it kind of creates conflict that's actually preventable. It creates violent disagreements.
Yeah.
Where something could have been preventable if somehow we had a culture in which men and women had a much better understanding
mm-hmm.
of each other's perspectives.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, reflecting back on that that episode, which has kind of stuck with me for a long time, because, well, I feel like I'm sort of poking fun at both of us, right? I don't really want to come across as saying that this young man, and he was very young at the time, right? He was just a few years older than me, was being kind of cruel, or I mean, maybe even in the sense we kind of both lacked empathy for each other, that, you know, there was a sense in which kind of neither of us like grasped like how the other one was affected by some of this. But I also felt like the thing that came out across to me when I was thinking about that is how young we both were, and that this is a reason I don't use his name in the book, because I feel like I want to believe that both of us have achieved like kind of higher levels of empathy, and that today we could have a better dialogue about that whole encounter, or if we were to do that again now, that we would have a better dialogue about it. I don't really see that as a kind of, that there's some unbridgeable gap between us, but there kind of was when we were both in our 20s. But I think, you know, maybe now with the benefit of like many, many more years of kind of like experience on both our parts, we wouldn't have quite the same interaction. But anyway, that's my hope.
Well, and on that hopeful note, we conclude our interview. So thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
You have just heard our interview with Dr. Kathleen Crowther about her book, Policing Pregnant Bodies, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Between the Bones is an independent podcast free of influence from Fortune 500 companies, governments, and political parties. You can hear more episodes on bridgingthebones.fyi, iTunes, or iHeartRadio. Thanks this week to Michael Hirsch for his version of Sarabande, originally by Gayle Candle. This is your host, Sodaline Wang, signing off.